All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the 10th day of March, 2020. I do want to thank all of you for listening to this show, making it one of the more popular shows in the Voice of America Business Channel. Also, would like to encourage you to send your comments along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions4taylor@gmail.com. And we do want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Today's sponsors are Ely Gold Royalties, Great Bear Resources, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Lion One Metals, Novo Resources, and Sitka Gold Corp. I've titled today's show, Two Ways to Profit from the Gold Share Bull Market. When I planned the topic of this show a couple of weeks ago, of course I was not aware that today we would be in the midst of a financial market meltdown. While the coronavirus is a so-called black swan that many commentators are blaming for the decline in the markets, if you are a regular listener to this show, you know very well that there has been a growing systemic weakness in our financial markets that would render a stock market crash inevitable with or without the coronavirus. The coronavirus has no doubt hastened the day of reckoning that has seen a major decline in equity markets, including the Dow Jones losing a record 2,000 points yesterday. Given the fact that the virus is not the cause but simply a catalyst for triggering financial market chaos, there is no reason to believe that the decline is over yet, despite a bit of a bounce today in the equity markets. I'm looking at the Dow, for example, up 666 points as I speak. While these downturns can be extremely painful, successful investors look at such events as profit opportunities. I've often been asked whether when the next equity bear market arrives, will gold and gold shares get taken down with the market as a whole? From my experience, the answer is that they will be taken down. At least the shares will be taken down initially with all the other shares. The same to a lesser extent of gold. But as the central banks begin massive money printing to keep the financial markets from total destruction, tangible assets begin to rise dramatically, and that is most certainly true of gold, and even more so with the successful gold exploration companies and gold mining shares. Gold itself is performing very well, I must admit. In fact, so far in the month of March, the average London PM fix is $1,640. That compares to $1,597 for the month of February. As I was preparing for today's show, gold was successfully testing the 1650 level. And as Michael Oliver's work reveals, the dollar is now breaking down, which should provide wind at the back of gold, taking the yellow metal upwards towards what Michael sees as the first significant resistance level of 1700. So while there are difficult days like today when gold gives up around 30 bucks at one point anyway, the yellow metal has held up extremely well compared to equities. It has indeed been a safe haven. The topic of today's show suggests two different kinds of gold mining stocks that I believe can lead to very significant profits in the years to come. In just a moment, we will be going to our first commercial break, and when we return, Trey Wasser will be with me to explain how Ely Gold Royalties is building a very significant portfolio of gold production royalties and how that company's shares have been outperforming gold shares in general, and they've weathered this storm better than most, I should note. In the second half of today's show, Ben Mossman, the president and CEO of Rise Gold, will join me to talk about how that company is moving the famous Idaho Maryland gold mine, located in Grass Valley, California, back into production. Now, this was the second most prolific gold mine in the United States after the famous Homestake mine until it was closed by edict during World War II. The mine is now in the permitting stage, and from what I can see, this high-grade gold deposit has the potential to pick up where it left off in the early 1940s by producing upwards to 100,000 ounces of gold or more. Should be very high-margin ounces, I might add, at the historic Idaho Maryland gold mine. So I'm very optimistic that Idaho Maryland, that the Idaho Maryland mine will be highly profitable. And an investment that should do extremely well for investors who recognize the potential of this project before the shares begin to rise along with profitable production. We do have to go to a commercial break now, but right after that, Trey Wasser will be with me, followed by Ben Mossman in the second half of today's show. We will go to break now, but don't go away because Trey Wasser will be with me right after the first commercial break. Don't go away. I'll be right back.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me for the first time Trey Wasser. He's the president and CEO and a director of Ely Gold Royalties. Trey's career includes being president and director of research for Pilot Point Partners that gave him over 33 years of brokerage and venture capital experience, and he has spent 20 years as a corporate finance specialist with Merrill Lynch, Kidder Peabody, and Payne Weber. Trey specialized in equity and debt restructuring and cash management. So with that kind of background, it's not hard to understand that his current role in forming and managing Ely Gold Royalties is a natural fit. And indeed, since its inception, that company has richly rewarded shareholders. The shares have risen from around 20 cents or so in Canadian money earlier this year to over a dollar in February before getting trimmed back here to around 70 cents earlier today when I looked at the market. It was trading around 70 cents in Canadian money. Not so bad compared to many of the other companies that I follow in the junior gold mining space with the carnage that's taken place over the last few days of the equity markets. Ely trades in Toronto. ELY is the symbol. You can buy it down here in the States, as I have, under ELYGF, 113 million shares. At 70 cents, giving it a market cap of around Canadian $80 million. While early shareholders have done very well with Ely Gold, the key question for investors who understand the value of investing in gold and silver royalties companies is what kind of growth path might shareholders anticipate going forward with Ely? And so I'm really pleased to have Trey with us to answer that question and more. Thanks for joining me, Trey.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Really good to have you, and especially it's good to have someone that hasn't had a total bloodbath in these recent days, which the gold shares have gotten taken down along with all the rest. In fact, a lot of the more speculative juniors have been taken down as hard or harder than the Dow Jones, I must say. So, Trey, until the last few years, gold shares in general, they have, I mean, I should say the last few days, not a few years, the last few days, gold shares in general have performed very well, but yours have outperformed most other junior companies, and perhaps more importantly, as I just noted, Ely has done relatively well, or has fared relatively well in these recent days. How do you account for the good fortunes that Ely has offered its shareholders compared to most junior share gold companies?
Well, Jay, I think there's a few things. As you pointed out, you know, over the last year we've had a rising gold price at our back. What really has changed for us in the last 12 to 18 months is two things. We brought on two high-profile institutional investors in Rick Rule and Eric Sprott. And we've also been expanded our business plan to include buying, producing, and near-term producing royalties. And as we've made those acquisitions of near-term producing royalties and producing royalties, the market has really responded. And being a junior company, and in that, you know, as you pointed out, $80 million market cap, these transactions in royalties that might be producing $1 million, $2 million a year in revenue for us, every one of those moves the needle at our market cap.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Rick Rule. Are there some other notable investors?
Eric Sprott I mentioned as well. And Eric Sprott,
and Rick
those
Rule,
are the two institutional investors that got involved, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, one of the factors that caused me to add Ely to my newsletter was the fact that unlike some of the other startup royalty companies, you seem to have managed to acquire producing properties or properties that are very near production. So you actually have some cash flow early on. I know another royalty company that I had covered for a while, you know, looking out 2, 3, 4 years before they start to see cash flow. Can you talk about your business model perhaps and what your criteria are for getting involved as a royalty company with these different projects?
Well, yes. Historically, Jay, we've been prospectors, primarily in Nevada and Western United States, where we have been acquiring and staking properties, and rather than joint venturing those, we a few years ago started with a royalty business model where we sell those properties and retain royalties. So we have several royalties that are, you know, more on the exploration and development side, but those are royalties that we didn't purchase. We actually got paid through the property sales and generated revenue there. And then, as I said, we've purchased a couple of producing royalties. We just announced a deal to purchase a 0.5% net smelter royalty on the producing Jerritt Canyon mine. That's going to produce about $1.5 million a year in revenue. We also purchased a net profit interest on the Rawhide mine and a NSR on the newly producing, the mine that just went into commercial production by Gold Resource Corp called Isabella Pearl. Mm-hmm. So we've because of our contacts, we've managed to find these royalties that are, you know, currently producing revenue, and it's really given us a leg up and the cash flow to then do some deals that might be producing in a year or two. They purchased one on the Fenelon property that Wallbridge is having incredible success with up in Quebec. That's our one Canadian asset. Mm-hmm. And then a recent purchase that we announced on producing Marigold mine, the deposits that on the claims we purchased will start producing in 2022, and also on the Wren mine, which is a large deposit at the Goldstrike complex for Barrick, and we expect that to be producing possibly as early as 2022 as well. So we've got a nice pipeline with our producing royalties, a pipeline of things coming on stream in 2021 and 22, and all of that revenue is then also complemented with our property sales, where we, you know, sell the properties and also generate a royalty.
To sell the properties, do you have a criteria for selling the properties? I mean, how do you know what to sell, when to sell it, and do you do a certain amount of exploration work yourself, or do you leave that totally to others?
We leave that totally to others. We are strictly prospectors. We have a leg up in Nevada with we have Jerry Bachman, who's runs our Nevada subsidiary, has been prospecting for over 35 years, staking properties, acquiring properties, selling them, and retaining royalties. He successfully sold a royalty company that actually ended up at Frontier and then Newmont, and now is with the Cisco Royalties. And we also, one of our directors, Bill Sheriff, has also 35 years out there. So prospecting, staking properties, retaining royalties, also was successful creating and selling a royalty business. So we've got a top-notch team with all of their data over 35 years, and we generate some quality properties. And for that reason, our partners, the people that we're selling, the companies we're selling these properties to, are literally the who's who of operating and exploration companies in Nevada.
Yeah, name some of those, if you would. I think you mentioned...
I mentioned Gold Resource Corporation, McEwen Mining, Premier Gold Mines, Integra, Barrick, and of course the joint venture interest with the Marigold, that'll add SSR Mining. We have a near-term producing property with Coeur. So we've, literally the who's who, as I say, of the producers and majors and mid-tiers operating in Nevada and the western United States.
Yeah, having good partners is obviously an essential thing, and you certainly do have some premier partners, no doubt about that. Can you give us some sense of what you might be looking at in terms of cash flow over the years? I know you can't really, it's a forward-looking statement, and you can't really say, but you'll have some cash flow this year, right?
Well, look, we had we did just under $4 million in revenue last year, and keeping in mind that we operate like a royalty company, and one of the essentials of a royalty company is a very low overhead. So, Jerry and I are actually the only two full-time employees at the company. We have a office in Reno, and we share office space in Vancouver for our corporate office. So so our burn rate is right about $500,000 a quarter on a cash basis. So in this year, we're looking on the books right now from our producing royalties and our contracts of our property sales. We're starting out the year with about $4 million in revenue. We'll add on to that this about $1.5 million from the Cherokee Canyon royalty. And then with our normal property sales we do throughout the year, I think we're probably looking at about somewhere in the $6 million revenue this year, growing to $8 to $10 million next year. And with these new acquisitions, I think we'll be up in the 12 to $15 million in revenue by 2022.
Well, you've got a very low burn rate right now. As you grow, though, it's going to be hard to keep that at $500,000 a quarter, I suppose. Anyway.
Well, you know, not really, because the beauty of both our of the royalty business is, you know, we don't do any of the exploration. We don't do any of the heavy lifting of the operating. Once you have that royalty, it's like being a bondholder. You're just basically clipping a coupon, getting a percentage off the top of the sales at the mine. So, you know, our and that's that just doesn't require a lot of back office work. The And we also manage our sale portfolio, our properties that are being sold, or the same way, by doing the royalty model and just selling the properties on a 100% basis. We're not involved in any JV meetings or anything like that. Once we sell the property, all we do is send them an invoice. So it's really a cash business. What takes the time and our energy is for Jerry finding the properties and for Jerry and myself finding these royalties that are for sale from third parties.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, royalty companies generally get much higher multiples in the market than, say, the producers. Give us an idea what sort of multiples that a good royalty company, a streaming or royalty company, might get.
Well, yeah, it's a kind of a tiered system.
Sure.
You have and now I'm talking about precious metal royalties here, Jay.
Right.
Yes.
when
we talk about this group, and of course with Ely, you know, not only are we focused in Nevada, the number one mining jurisdiction, but we are almost entirely focused on gold. Some of the other streaming companies will be, you know, have some silver and some base metals, but generally it depends on size. So your three largest royalty companies, the Franco-Nevada, Royal Gold, and Wheaton Precious Metals, and now, you know, I'm quoting some numbers here before this, the market pulling back, but trading at over 25 times cash flow, and really over two times net asset value, and and then in the mid tier companies that maybe have more development kind of royalties and not as big of a portfolio, that Sandstorms and Mavericks and that half a billion to a billion plus market cap. They drop back a bit. They'll be 1.5 times net asset value and maybe around 20 times cash flow. And then down in the junior space where we are, you know, of course, you value those companies a lot more on the blue sky and what that portfolio is going to look like a couple years out and saying, you know, what, and that's where you have to look at us and, you know, apply those multiples to the cash flow that'll be coming in 2021, 2022, and a lot of blue sky involved in the valuation there.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of your peers in the junior space, Abitibi, Metalla, and yourselves. And it looks like you're the only one. Well, I guess Abitibi has one producing producer. Metalla doesn't have any at this point in time, and this is from pretty recent data, and you have three. So,
Metalla has two streams that are producing, so
it
would be fair to them. But on the royalty side, I think we're about equal to our currently with this last acquisition we made. I think Metalla has around 45, 46 royalties. We're up around 42.
Mm-hmm.
And Abitibi, I think, has a total of about 28. So and on a revenue basis, we're about the same. Metalla showed a little bit higher revenue last year, but a chunk of that was one-time gain. So I think, you know, we're very similar on the operating, and, you know, it's up to the investor, of course, to look at those portfolios and see who's going to look stronger as time goes on and projects come online. You know, I think even today with the adjustments in the prices and everything, we're still selling at a fraction, less than half of Metalla's market cap and right around half of Abitibi's, I believe.
No, it looks very favorable. That's for sure. What should investors really be watching for? Do you have any news coming down the pike that they should really have their eyes on? And as you start to perform, what might be the share drivers they should be focused on?
One share driver for us, I won't come out as news, but of course you just pointed it out, that comparing us to some of the other, our peers in the junior space, we think we still are undervalued there and should be re-rated in the market. But as far as news flow, we have a lot of it because we're doing deals all the time, either on the property sales side or the royalty side. So, for instance, this year we set out with a goal of buying 4 producing or near-term producing royalties, which is what we purchased last year. And as it stands now, in the first 2 months of the year, we've purchased 4. Ah. So we're certainly going to beat that. And we're just going to keep buying these producing royalties as opposed to. Where the beauty of our model is those longer-term exploration development royalties, we don't spend shareholders' money for those. We create mm-hmm. those through our sale portfolio and actually get paid while we're doing that. Mm-hmm. So we're able to save all our money for the producing royalties. And at this stage, like I said, at our market cap, when we can go out and buy the quality of royalties like this Wren and Marigold, on big producing mines. I mean, I would point out to your listeners that the Wren royalty we just purchased, operated by the joint venture Barrick and Newmont, it's right in the middle of their complex at Goldstrike that's produced right. over 50 million ounces. That just has the right. potential to be a home run
All
for
right.
us.
All right, Trey, unfortunately, we're out of time. You got a lot to look forward to. I'm really going to be watching carefully and keeping our listeners and my subscribers appraised of what's going on. This is an exciting time, and I think a good time to take a look at your shares, given the fact they've been trimmed back a bit with this market turmoil. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll look to do it again sometime in the future. Well, folks, that is all the time we have for this segment, but don't go away because Ben Mossman, he'll be with us right after the break, the president of Rise Gold. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQX, is a gold exploration company focused on their 23-kilometer, wholly owned Dixie project in the prolific Red Lake mining district of Ontario. Having recently made multiple high-grade gold discoveries, GBR is fully funded to complete a very active 200,000-meter drill program through to the year 2021. Stay up to date on what has been considered one of the best performing exploration stocks in the last 2 years by visiting greatbearresources.ca.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me today Ben Mossman. He is the president and CEO of Rise Gold Corp. I invited Ben on the show today to talk about Rise Gold Corp because I believe it is a very undervalued company that is moving what was once the second most prolific gold mine in America back into production. I'm talking about the Idaho Maryland mine in Nevada County, California, and it was second only to the Great Homestake mine until it was closed down in World War II. Ben is a very experienced mining engineer who has been very successful in the past with companies like De Beers Canada and Alexco Resources Corp. And so Ben's skills are geared not to mining exploration so much as to actually putting mines into production. And that is totally appropriate given the fact that the main asset that RISE has is the Idaho-Nevada gold mine located at Grass Valley, California. It's already has a very significant high-grade gold deposit that is probably at least as large as all the gold that was mined so far, a couple of million ounces of high-grade gold. And in my view, based on what I know, this is potentially a very profitable gold mining project that is being moved as we speak towards production. RISE is currently selling at around 60 cents in U.S. money. It has only 22 million shares outstanding. This is a minuscule market cap of a little over $13 million. Of the 22 million shares outstanding, fewer than half of that number are in the public float, meaning that it may be very difficult to pick up shares once this story starts to be heard and understood and believed by mining investors. Believing very much that this company's prospects are very good, I purchased shares personally on the market and have recommended the shares to my subscribers to J. Taylor's Gold Energy and Tech Stocks. So I'm very pleased to have Ben Mossman with me. Thanks for joining me today, Ben.
Thanks a lot, Jay.
It's really good to have you. You know, I would like to start out by asking you to give us a brief history of the Idaho-Maryland mine. As I noted, it was in production until World War II. It was one of the more significant, if not perhaps the second most significant gold mine in the United States up until that time. When was hard rock gold discovered there? And you know, how much was produced, and give us some idea of the grades that were produced there?
Sure. This area here in Nevada County was you know, one of the first areas where the gold rush started, you know, in 1849. So the 49ers came out, they started with the placer gold, and then in 1851 they found the outcrop of the ore body, which was called Eureka at the time. And so they kind of started to realize, you know, that the gold was in the quartz as well. And so 1851 they found it. Spent a few years, you know, trying to figure out how to get the gold out of it, and so by 1863, they sunk a shaft down into the vein, and they found the main chute of the ore, and was grading 1.3 ounces per ton, so very high grade. And then that kind of catapulted the company back then into becoming the leading gold producer in the United States, you know, way back in 1865. And at one time, it was the deepest mine in the entire United States. So that vein that they discovered, which is now called the One Vein, produced almost a million ounces of gold at over an ounce per ton from one single vein. So just one vein, they mined it until about 1900. The owners at the time were the Coleman brothers, which were quite famous in California, especially in that era. So it became very wealthy, and then the vein, you know, went off to the next claim, which was the Maryland claim. And so it went from the Eureka claim to the Idaho claim to the Maryland claim, and that's why it's called the Idaho-Maryland Mine. So as it went on to the next person's claim, they would take over the mining. And so they finished the mining of that number one vein in about 1900, and then it sat idle for a few years. In the 20s, a group from New York financed the dewatering of the mine. So they pumped all the water out. They started looking around for more ore, and they were within, you know, a couple feet of finding the next vein over, which is, you know, just a little offset from the one vein, which is called the three vein. And so that group gave up, and an engineer called Aaron McBoyle, who was involved in the project and put the whole deal together, you know, took over the project, and then right away, you know, within a year, cross-cut right into the three vein, which is extremely high grade. It produced over 600,000 on its own. And some of the ore coming out there, you know, was 3 ounces per ton. And so that vein averaged about 20 grams per ton over its history. And then quickly kind of built up the mine. They built the production. They were up, you know, past 1,000 tons per day in about 1940, producing over 120,000 ounces of gold a year. It's the second biggest little gold mine in the entire United States, second only to the Homestake mine, which, of course, is, you know, a huge deposit that was mined at that time and then mined for a long time after. And so was eventually, by the 42, they were going through a big expansion phase. So they're already over 120,000 ounces gold a year. They wanted to double the production to go from 1,000 tons a day to 2,000 tons per day. And they put a brand new headframe up. They were sinking a shaft as fast as they could. They got down to 3,200 feet before it was shut down, and they were trying to get it down to 5,000 feet. So not only was it, you know, a major mine, but they were also, you know, at the very date where they were going to double the production from there. And so the total production from the history of the mine is 2.4 million ounces of gold at an average head grade of 0.5 ounce per ton. So,
wow.
So that's after mine dilution. That's what was actually fed into the mill. So extremely high grade. And of that 2.4 million ounces, the one vein itself produced 935,000 ounces at 1.1 ounces per ton. So,
wow. Incredibly rich. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so was the mine, let's say back in 1940 when they reached 120,000 ounces, was it a pretty profitable endeavor? I mean, at that time, I guess the gold price was what?
Before 1934, it was about $20 an ounce. And in 1934, they increased the price to $35 an ounce. So it was making money at $20 an ounce. But when they raised the price of gold to $35, of course, it was making, you know, a lot more. And during the last 5 years of its production, it was producing at $6 per ton and $18 an ounce. So they're selling for $35 and producing at $18.
Okay.
And the main shareholder, Aaron McBoyle, who had something around half the company stock, you know, became extremely wealthy from the mine. He had you know, racehorses and orchards and you know, private planes and all those things. So it had it was very profitable. They paid back all of their they had all the preferred shareholders they paid back who financed the capital to put the mine back into production, and then of course paid dividends to their common shareholders. But I think it's you look at the history, anyone who had invested the mine from, you know, the early 1800s all the way to the end, except for this one group from New York who kind of gave up, you know, one round short of the ore body, they all made a profit on their investment. So
it's been a very profitable endeavor, Ben. And so you mentioned they were going to continue mining to depth and actually double the production. What do you know now about the extent of the gold mineralization at depth from where they the old workings?
When we first purchased the property in 2017, the family that owned the property had all the historic documents, and they kept all of them in very good condition. So thousands of maps, you know, documents of where they were mining, notes, reports. So we had a good idea that, you know, they had just kind of just they'd be forced to shut down by the government. They could just drop the tools and left. And there's places there that you know, they have channel samples in the tunnel where they're mining when they stopped that, you know, were over 10 ounces per ton, you know. So we had a good idea that there's a lot of ore left there. And their plan to sink the shaft down to 5,000 feet, of course, that, you know, they weren't able to really do core drilling like we're able to do now. They could drill horizontal holes a couple hundred feet. So they weren't able to drill down deep to see how far it goes, but based on their, you know, on the geology, they expected that it would. So that's why they were sinking the shaft to 5,000 feet. And so when we started drilling on the property, we drilled about 18 holes, but deep holes, widely spaced, to basically see like how far these veins continue to depth. And we had, you know, some really excellent results. The deepest hole we had was, you know, over 1,000 meters below the where they had stopped mining. And we hit their 24 grams per ton over 4.5 meters. So that was the deepest hole. And then we've had, hits as high as 64 ounces per ton over a foot and a half, 13 ounces per ton over, you know, 3 feet, ounce over 3.5 feet. So basically, you know, almost everywhere you drill, and we've drilled over, you know, probably a square mile of area through these widely spaced holes, we've hit, you know, high grade gold, which is very favorable to the idea that these veins will continue a long ways down.
The big issue that I hear whenever I tell people your story, Ben, is that it's in California and you can't get permitted. You can't mine. The Californian people, environmentally sensitive people, are not interested in seeing a gold mine being built there. You can take a few minutes perhaps to let our listeners know why you think they're wrong.
Yeah, and so this obviously has a big question for investors, and it kind of starts, you know, back in the 90s when you know, gold, there's a lot of gold in California, and so at that time, you know, they had just kind of figured out how to do open pit heap leach mining, and so a lot of companies came to California and built open pit heap leach mines beside, you know, all these little towns.
Mm-hmm.
In the North Sierra, which obviously it doesn't make them too popular, and so there was a big pushback from California State on open pit heap leach mines, and forced a lot of mining companies out, and a lot of companies just left and never came back. but what we're talking about here is an underground mine, so it's a lot less environmental impact. And then in this case, because all the land was patented, you know, back in the gold rush days, it's all private land. And so because it's private land in California, the land decisions are made by on the county level. And so the property is located in Nevada County, California, and the permit that we're applying for is a use permit to reopen the mine, and the discretionary power is with the county. And so that's a big point.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to deal with some state agencies for some secondary permits,
mm-hmm.
but all the discretionary power is with the county. And so you have to go through the California Environmental Quality Act, which kind of lays out what has to be studied. But if you look through all these issues, which we prepare all these technical reports and then done our designs on, there's very few impacts. You know, there's no significant impact from noise, you know, dust. Working on the groundwater, we don't think that that's going to be an issue as far as the drawdown of the groundwater table.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing water treatment so that the water that's coming out, that's being discharged from the mine, that you're pumping out the mine, is clean to drinking water, are better than drinking water quality. So there's very few impacts, and that's going to really start coming out in the next short while, where people are going to see through these technical reports that, you know, this is going to be just a wonderful project for this area that has no impacts. Basically, you can't hear it, you're not going to be able to see it, and the water's, you know, perfectly clean, and there's a number of things like that. So we've looked at this for a long time and spent a lot of time thinking about how it should be designed and built. And so we think that the political environment here is also very favorable to getting it permitted. And so that's going to come out over time. And I think once people see that process in action with this permit, that they're gonna have a different view for me.
Well, Ben, how much time? I mean, that's always the question. What I know it's impossible to predict exactly when government people will act and will give you the permission. But can you give our listeners some sense of timing on this?
We've submitted the application for the use permit, and this is the main discretionary permit. And so that permit was submitted in November a couple months ago. And then what right now the county is hiring a third-party consultant. And so this is kind of one of the advantages over other jurisdictions, is that the county, it hires the consultant to write the environmental assessment report, and then RISE pays for the cost. So the consultant works with the county to write the draft report, and basically they take all the reports that our consultants have written on all these different areas, and then they peer review them, and then they write the impact report to go through this big list of questions to say, okay, what's the impact? And then if there is an impact, what's the mitigation? And so that hiring process we expect will be completed in March. And then as soon as they're hired, they'll start working on writing the draft EIR, which could take about 4 or 5 months. Once that's written, then it goes to the public comment period. And so that's where you're going to really start seeing it more in the public realm. And so there's a 45-day comment period where basically people in the county, other government agencies can comment on the project. And so once you have all these comments in, the consultant, he takes those comments and he has to answer every single one of them. And so comments to be like, well, I just don't like gold mining, those comments are really easy to answer because that's not due with the environmental effects of the project. So it's comments that, you know, are technical in nature that that take the most time to answer. And those are the questions that are important. And so once those comments are answered, it goes to the final environmental impact report. And then that goes to the county planning commission, and then the county supervisors. The county supervisors are 5 elected officials in the county, and they have the final vote on whether it's approved or not.
All right. So do you think maybe as we get towards the end of the year, the public might start to see this is a very environmentally friendly project?
Yeah, and that's really where it comes out, because, I mean, there's a lot of technical information already out in the public domain. But, you know, it's a lot to read through and understand. And so the summary of it in this environmental assessment, you know, basically answers questions that people are, you know, worried about. Well, what about greenhouse gases? You know, the answer's in there. You know, it's not significant, and all those different areas. And so you know, there's always a few people that are, you know, against growth and things like that. But overall, like having been here, I've lived here for over a year and a half. The great majority of people that you meet are favorable to the project, and that's before even really understanding, you know, the impacts of the projects, which we believe are very, very few impacts. So I think you're going to see a lot of local support as this thing moves through the process. And then, you know, that'll be a stage where investors, you know, who aren't here, will have a better idea of the probability of success and also the timing of success. So it's a bit up in the air exactly when it would get approved. You know, we've said basically 12 to 18 months from November. So you could be looking at, you know, in a good case, the end of this year, if it's going to take a bit longer, you're looking, say, like 1 year from today. That's our goal.
Okay, Ben, let me ask you with regard to the economics. You indicated a bit ago that it was costing $6 a ton, $35 on the top end. So that left a pretty strong margin. I want to ask you if you expect to do any economic studies anytime soon, a PEA at least, or even a bankable feasibility study, if you might do that. And I know it's a forward-looking statement, but do you have a sense of whether or not those same kind of margins, better or worse, might be possible going forward? Because those are very, very strong margins. Obviously, if you had the same margins today with the, you know, $1,600 gold, you'd be looking at something over $1,000 an ounce, maybe.
Yeah. So, yeah, the interesting thing about historic numbers and inflation is that, if you take the standard kind of inflation numbers, and you probably know more about this than I do, but if you take that, that $6 a ton and times it by 18, you end up with about $110 a ton, and so. $110 a ton is in the range of what you would expect based on other operations production rates. So the, you know, a mine around 1,000 tons per day, you look at some comparables, you know, they would be producing from about $100 to up to $230 per ton. And that's same range, same type of ore body, same grade. And so the cost per ounce, of course, depends a lot on the grade of the,
sure,
of the deposit. So if you're looking at, say, the $100 to $250 per ton range, you know, you'd have to kind of do your own calculations and your own speculations on what the actual mine grade is. But you know, we're looking at a higher grade mine. That's what our goal is to, you know, we're looking at this as a higher grade mine. Of course, the average production was 0.5 ounce per ton. We've had quite a few good drill results. But there's not enough drilling there to calculate a resource. So we don't have a resource, so we can't, you know, say what the grade is going to be. So it takes a bit of speculation to consider that, but that's kind of the range you're looking at, you know, $100, $250 per ton, and then if you use just straight inflation on the old cost, it'd be about $110. And the interesting thing about that inflation is that if you use that same inflation number on the price of gold from $35, it would be $600 an ounce, and of course now it's trading something like $1,600.
Exactly. Yeah. So you would think the margins, just back of the envelope here, it looks like the margins could be quite good. And you said the average grades were half an ounce a ton. I'm wondering, Ben, to what extent you might pick up some lower grade material now with higher gold prices. Although I suppose you don't know that at this point in time.
We've put out a number of different news releases about drill results. And so there are areas there where there's, you know, three veins close together. And then the material in between is also have gold in it, you know, a couple of grams per ton, which most likely be worthwhile taking the entire block, you know, all three veins to be mined at once and still
sure.
come out with a very, very good grade. And so when we started drilling, you know, we didn't know that we could actually hit this with the high grade material that they had, you know, talked about mining in the past. But but surprisingly, you know, we did. We hit quite a few holes with visible gold, and of course, you know, the highest one was at 64 ounces per ton. But so it's quite incredible, really, that you can hit something like that from such a far distance on surface. So
yeah.
So there's a lot of potential. I think once you won't really know the true answer to that until you get underground and start mining in some of these different veins. But you are going to find, you know, these areas where you have this extremely high grade, and it could be that, you know, you blend that in with some lower grade, you mine some of the lower grade as water width. And so a lot of those kind of questions as far as grade are what you would mine, or what's economic, or what is the best strategy to mine won't be known until...
Right, until you get underground. All right, Ben. So I'm wondering, will you be doing any formal economic studies anytime soon, or might you just get down there and start mining and then continue to mine going forward as you go, and as you do the work down, underneath the ground, you can start to understand better the prospects?
Yeah, it could be done either way, and we haven't decided which way is best, and we probably won't know that until we get further into this permitting process, and a lot of it depends on the market as well. And so you basically have two basic strategies. You know, one is that you get the permit and then you drill out, drill more holes from surface to prepare a resource. And then when you have to have that resource in place, then you prepare, you know, either a PEA study or a feasibility study, depending on the level or the detail of the drilling. And so that's the conventional way to do it. And that can be done. We've had a lot of success from our drilling from surface, so we feel confident that it could be drilled from surface. And the other way is that, you know, once you get that use permit in place, you kind of immediately go and start dewatering the mine. And so you got to pump all the water out of the mine, which would take about 6 months to get all that water out. You know, you get back underground, and then, of course, now you're drilling right beside the vein, so the drilling, the drill holes are a lot shorter. You can actually, you know, go and touch the veins because they're right in the existing tunnel. So you get more work done for your money, and of course you're that much closer to production because, you know, the mine is already dewatered and you're down there. So there's advantages to each, and that'll kind of depend on where we're at once this permit gets in place. And basically our strategy right now is, because we think that, you know, the company is very undervalued, we think that by getting this permit, that's going to result in a major, you know, re-rating the value of the stock, because that seems to be the most concern. We don't often hear people questioning, you know, the quality of the property from a gold point of view. People's most concerns is to do with, can it be permitted?
Right, so exactly.
That's the first thing to resolve, and then after that, you know, there's a few different ways to advance property that we haven't really committed to either at this point.
Ben, just with a couple of minutes left here yet, recently I was talking to a major shareholder of Rise, and he noted that prior to the 1970, for example, in the 1940s, 90% of the cash flow for the Idaho Maryland mines was paid out to the shareholders. But I'm wondering, you know, and there was some thought that possibly, given the legal structure in the United States for resource projects, that a master limited partnership might be a possibility, whereby a large percentage of the cash flow is actually paid out to the owners of the company. Of course, in that way, allowing to avoid the double taxation that is the bane of American corporations to a great extent. But is there some thought that might be a route that the company takes in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we've looked at it into a few different advantages of different structures. And so one of the unique things about Rise is that it's a U.S. company, and so, which is unusual because, you know, most companies, they start out as Canadian companies, of course. And so Rise is a U.S. company, and it's a, you know, SEC reporting issuer, which opens up a few different avenues. And so, you have the master limited partnership, which we're looking into. And then there's also another, kind of new tax benefit that's being set up called an opportunity zone. And so they've laid out different areas of, you know, where I have higher unemployment, higher poverty, and the mine actually sits in one of these opportunity zones, which there's some tax benefits to that, which requires some structuring to make it work, but that's something we're looking to as well. And the main thing is that, you know, Rise is focusing 100% on Idaho, Maryland. We have no plans to, you know, acquire some property up in Manitoba or something. You know, this is our focus. I think a lot of investors, you know, are quite, you know, tired of, you know, they have success on a project, and then the company, you know, goes and buys, you know, some other projects, so that the money is always invested to growth rather than being paid back to the investors. And so that's our model, and that's what we want this to become. And so the structure of that, you know, something that has to be thought about over time. But I think that by the time we get to these permits, we should have a pretty good idea of
what's
the most favorable structure for the investors.
Wonderful. Well, just one more thing. We're just about out of time here, Ben, but I've mentioned that you have only 22 million shares outstanding. Can you give us an idea of how many of those shares might be in the float? Because it's my belief that this is a very tight share structure, obviously, with just 22 million shares. But if a large percentage of those are even owned by a handful of people, then that means there's not a lot of stock out there for people to buy.
Yeah. So the largest two shareholders, which is Yamana Gold and Southern Arc, they own 25% of the stock. And so we don't expect that they would sell it anytime soon. Of course, they're able to sell whenever they want, but they've invested for strategic reasons. You know, Yamana's a bit different than Southern Arc. Yamana's, of course, interested in gold projects because they're a large gold producing company. And then Southern Arc is more like a typical investor looking for a return on their investment and their holdings. And then so 25% is with those two shareholders. And then we have quite a few shareholders that we have, you know, strong relationships with that we would talk to, you know, once a week or something. So I would think that was probably over another 25%. So you might have, you know, somewhat less than half the stock, you know, kind of in available for trading or that people might trade. So it has traded pretty good. It does have, you know, pretty good volumes for a small company. The price isn't that high, but it does have, you know, decent liquidity for the size of the company. And
so it's possible at this stage to buy stock. And I think, though, that my view is that when people start to realize that this is a real project, a real mine, a very potentially very robust economic story, that people are likely to get much more interested in it than they have been at this time when they're still sort of figuring, nothing's going to happen there. It's in California, so.
It's been a bit quiet lately. You know, it's because, you know, it's a bit boring to file tech reports.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's I don't think it's just going to wait until the final approval. I think as these things progress, there is going to be news flow as far as, you know, the results of these technical reports, the you know, public comment periods, and as things kind of move through the process, I think people will, you know, the people that spend the time to actually, you know, watch it and read through these different reports and come to their own conclusions on the probability of success and the timing, I think you'll start seeing you know, more people you know, buying the stock. And the other thing is that we have raised a fair bit of money this summer, so we have all the funds in place so that we don't have to finance until that permit is completed. So we won't be issuing stock from the treasury. So if investors want to buy position in the company, they would buy on the market.
On the market. All right. Well, very good, Ben. This is a very exciting story, but I see the potential here of something that I think could be very significant for investors who recognize what you're doing there. Ben, I want to thank you so much for the time that you've spent with us, and we'll look forward to keeping up with the story as this year progresses. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks a lot, Jay.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Lion One Metals, one of 2019's top-performing gold stocks, is geared for aggressive growth in 2020. With drilling underway at its fully permitted high-grade Tuvatu Gold Project in Fiji, one of the last high-grade gold deposits of its kind anywhere in the world, not owned by a major gold mining company, Lion One trades in the USA on the OTCQX under the symbol LOMLF and in Canada under LIO on the TSXV. To learn more about Lion One's world-class high-grade gold potential in Fiji, go to liononemetals.com.